Welcome back, everyone, to our second study session. Hopefully this one will be a little bit more smooth than the last one, and I won't get cut off. I've been on here for 10-15 minutes already, I think, and it seems to be doing okay. Hopefully everyone can hear me. Maybe I'll just type a message. Okay, so first, before we start today, we've gotten as far as, well, in the document it says, we are here. The part that's, ete ko bhikkhave ubho ante anupagamma. But first I'd like to open the floor. I don't know if anyone's been looking at the text over the week or thinking about it, or thought about it and had some questions about it from last week. But as I said last time, I think one aspect of this session should be that the questions really define the quality of it. So if people have questions, please feel free to ask. The other aspect of the session that I hope to stress is that it should be, I guess, what could be called immersive, in the sense that we take this to heart and we actually try to put into practice these teachings, even at the time when we're studying. So we don't want, even though I think questions will be a good thing. I wouldn't want everyone to just sit around and trying to think up questions or think about the text. We should try to make it kind of practical, in the sense that here we are sitting together and hopefully also practicing at the same time. This is how it went with the five ascetics, of course. Listening to the Buddha, they were also practicing and reflecting and applying the teachings to their experience. At least Kondanya was. And as we'll see at the end, if you've read through the sutta, you see that at the end it says that Kondanya became enlightened as a result of, or he became a sotapanna as a result of this discourse. So okay, let's settle in. Everyone get in a comfortable position and set your mind on listening and thinking, but also meditating. So looking at your own thoughts and emotions and feelings and sensations, and applying the Buddha's teaching to it. Here we all have put aside devotion to indulgence of pleasures in the objects of sensual desire, and also we have given up devotion to self-torment. So that part is fine. Now we get into the good stuff, the actual path in the meditation. So let's try and make this at least a little bit meditative. So okay, just to open it up then, does anyone have any questions? And this is questions in regards, at least loosely in regards to the text, something that we've studied yesterday, last week, or something that we're coming up to now. Could even be, I suppose, something that's far ahead in the sutta. We're not really going to be strict about it. And if it's something far ahead, then I can prepare and I can post little post-it notes, my comments. Just wait a few minutes here to let everyone absorb the sutta and to think up any questions or to voice any questions they may have. The rest of us can just sit here and meditate. Okay, so here's a question. Is self-torment low, vulgar, and inferior? I think the distinction here, and it's something that's probably best to look up in the commentary, but then you just get the commentary's point of view anyway. So is that the devotion to self-torment? Well, there's two factors here. The first factor is that he's talking to some guys who are tormenting themselves. So he has to be careful about what he says. He can't say this is a stupid thing to do, right? He can't say, oh, he can't say it's low and vulgar. Or he could, but I think the choice is a wise one. He starts out with something that they'll agree with, and then he moves on to something that they will have trouble agreeing with. This is a classic tactic in argument and debate, and it would have been something that would have been quite familiar to everyone in the time, to all ascetics in the time of the Buddha. They would engage in these debates. So he sort of kind of pulls one on them here. He says the first part, and they're like sitting there, yeah, yeah, we agree with it. And suddenly they warm up to him, and then he hits them with the next part. But he has to be careful, because if he hits too hard, it'll turn them off. So he nuances it. He points out specifically what is the problem with self-torment, not saying it's a dumb, bad thing. As he said, with sensual desire, that's one factor. But I think obviously the other factor is that there is a difference between indulgence in pleasures of the sense. They really are quite apparently something that is low and vulgar. As we went over last week, the words actually are hino gammo. Here's the words, and I'll put them in italics here. Hino means inferior, or in this case it's translated as low, and gammo is translated as vulgar. But I should have looked it up. Here, I'll look it up here. Yeah, gamma does come from the word gamma. Gamma means village. So what it means is it's the way of the village people, and this is really the key distinction between these two, is that village people don't tend to torture themselves. At least they didn't in the time of the Buddha. The practice of self-torment was something that was taken up by ascetics. And so the Buddha was pointing out that in India at that time there were these two extreme sorts of practice. And as I said, you can relate it to present-day practice as well, but it had quite a bit more significance in that time, because there really were these two modes of life, and it was well established that these were the two ways. Either you had lots and lots of fun in this life and, you know, potentially suffered the consequences because of your clinging, or you went off and had lots and lots of pain and suffering in this life and theoretically benefited in the next life, or didn't have to be born again because of your torture in this life. Now the Buddha, and so people who went off into the forest were expected to practice in the latter way. People who stayed at home would practice in the former way, and so the former way was called gammo. And so here he's talking to monks, and he's saying, you know, obviously this is something that we don't do because it's gammo. It's something to do with the village people, people who live in a gama, with a long A, G-A, G-long A-M-A is gama. This village. And so that's really what's being said here. And the word that's what the word vulgar refers to. And in that sense of the word vulgar, self-torment is not vulgar. Although looking at people who torment themselves, we could say that the English word vulgar could be applied to self-torment. But really the implication here, or the idea here, the idea is that there is something a little bit more I mean, I guess theoretically admirable or spiritual about the self-torment. I mean, it's the recognition that torturing oneself is a spiritual practice. It just happens to be painful, ignoble, and useless. So ignoble in the sense that it doesn't lead you to become a arya, and leads to no good in the sense that it isn't connected with the goal. And one thing that should be pointed out here is this use of synonyms we're going to see again in the next paragraphs and really throughout the Buddha's teaching. It's something that we should take note of. It's a teaching method that I've found myself taking up as well. And I think Buddhist teachers in general or any kind of meditation teacher or spiritual teacher will wind up taking up. Because you're not just speaking to give intellectual knowledge. The use of synonyms helps to drive the point home in the person's mind. So imagine here we are sitting in the forest listening to this. If the Buddha says sensual desire is inferior, then he's just given them the tip of the iceberg, or he's just given them a taste of it. But when he drives it home, he says it's inferior, it's hino, gammo, potu janiko, anario, anatta sanghito. It really drives it home in their mind, and it really sets something up in their mind. And as I said, it probably brought about quite a bit of pleasure in their minds, happiness and faith in the Buddha as a result, because they're like, yes, yes, we agree with this. And then they're sitting there, and he hits them with it. And then he goes on, yo jayang attagilamatanu yogo dukho anario anatta sanghito. When he says this, it challenges them. And so that's where we are today. And this sets the stage. The sound might... We're probably going to have problems with the sound cutting in and out. Anyway, I'm recording this session, so it will be on my audio feed in the future. Please do let me know if the audio cuts in and out. It'll be nice to know what the approximate quality of the audio is, both in terms of audio quality and in terms of the stability of the signal, whether the audio is actually being constantly transmitted. Okay, so today we come on to Ete ko bhikkhave umbo ante anuppagamma manjima padipada tathagatena abhisambuddha chakku karni jnana karni upasamaya abhinyaya sambodhaya nibbanaya samvartati. And here you can right away see what I was talking about when I said this use of synonyms. This is a classic use of synonyms by a meditation teacher, by the perfect or the ultimate meditation teacher, is the Buddha. So he's not trying to tell. It would be a mistake to look at all these words and try to say, what does this word mean? What does this word mean? What's the difference between this word and this word? You'll see throughout the Buddha's teaching that he'll often give lists of things, and they often seem to be saying almost the same thing. And in such cases, you know, you might be able to find a distinction, but we have to remember that, again, it's not an intellectual exercise. The Buddha is trying to drive something home and is trying to change the person, the listener's mind. So by using synonyms, by repeating, by including this and including that, he reaches out to the audience. So in that sense, we're at a bit of a disadvantage here, because we're listening in on someone else's talk. But I think that's a very small disadvantage in this case, and in most cases of the Buddha's teaching, we really most of the Buddha's teaching is very, very general and applicable to all situations. But at any rate, this is the reason for using this, and it's something that we should take to heart. And so when we sit here, rather than trying to pull apart every word, we should try to get the flavor. So here is this famous middle way that we learn about in regards to the Buddha's teaching. And here we have how do you say middle way in Pali? It's Majjhima Padipada. Majjhima Padipada. Padipada is practice, and Majjhima means middle or medium. And so it's the practice of moderation. And as I said, this is a very dangerous word because people use this, the middle way, in everything. And so they'll use it as an excuse to do certain things. They'll say, I don't want to be too extreme, right? So when I'm at a party, I'll have one beer or two beer or something. Or I'll just watch a little bit of television or so on. Giving up this, giving up that, that would be too extreme. And I think we have to be wary of that. That actually, and as I said last week, the use of the word Majjhima Padipada is not throughout the Buddha's teaching. It's not something that he stresses, the fact that this is moderation or the fact that moderation is very important. It is important, and this is a great teaching, a wonderful teaching. But we shouldn't abuse this. And the importance is not the word middle way. The importance is the Eightfold Noble Way, as we're going to see. I have a few comments here. The words perfect isn't in the Pali. So he's really taking translator's license here. It's... I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have translated this as a perfect one. Because the word that he's translating is the word Tathagata. Tathagata means... Gata just means gone. The ena on the end is just a declension. It means by. So here we have by the Tathagata. Here you see by a perfect one, that means by the Tathagata. Isn't the middle way just the way the Buddha had to strain the fact that it was a new way? It was a spiritual path, but it wasn't based on self-tormenting, like most paths in those times. I don't think middle has much importance, really, right? Well, it does have importance, especially in this context, but I think that's the point, is this context really, it's really a vivid comparison here, the two extremes and then the middle way, because we have some guys who are acting very, very extreme here and who have taken on this extreme practice as a protest of the other extreme. Another thing is that it really does have a very profound significance for our practice, because we always do act in these two extremes. If we're not clear on how to practice, we either cling to, follow after the experience. Like if something good comes up, we might like it and attach to it and reach out to it and strive for it. Like maybe you're sitting here and you're thinking about your email. I forgot to mention before we start the course, I want everyone to shut down everything, your email, your Facebook, your instant messaging, your telephone, everything should be off. So now I've said it. But these can be tempting, and so then it takes you away, or you start to think about food and you want to go for a bite to eat or something. So this is the one way, is to go after the pleasure, to go after the desires. The other way that we might react is we might react like the five ascetics, and we know, oh no, that's bad, that's addiction, that's immoral, or so on, and so we repress it. Right? People come on the internet and they want to look up, all sorts of things, but there's a lot of sensual pleasure to be had on the internet. And so there are two ways. Either they go for it, or they repress it and say, no, that's bad, that's immoral, and so on. And really, I think the point of Vipassana meditation is that it avoids these two extremes. It avoids these two reactions. And so instead of reacting to the object, you're interacting with it, and you're kind of playing with it in a sense. So here you have this desire, or it works the same for aversion. If you don't like something, you either get angry and upset and push it and attack it, or so on. Or you repress your anger and try to pretend it didn't happen. And so instead of doing that, here we look at this desire. We examine it. And that's really what the Eightfold Noble Path is doing. It's sticking with the object. Kind of, as we said, interacting, I think, is the best word. So it examines it from all aspects, and when it comes up, it's like dodging and weaving and dancing with it, in a sense. And eventually it disappears. Another way, it might be like untying a knot. So instead of pushing and pulling, you actually reach in there and you untie it. See, untying a knot is not a simple thing. It's not just pulling, right? It's not just pushing or squeezing or however. It's untying, and it has some intricacy to it. And that's really what the middle way is. So it is a really good teaching, and I think as long as we understand it in that sense, in terms of spiritual practice, and don't try to apply it to everything, where every concept of moderation, where we then can do anything in moderation, then I think we're fine. And on the other side, it's the danger that we often find is people will criticize extreme practice of the Dhamma. So someone who puts up with painful feelings is often said to be torturing themselves. If you sit in meditation and then pain comes up and you don't move, you don't adjust your position, then you're torturing yourself. This is wrong understanding of the middle way, of the extremes. Because there's a key difference here, and it's that the person who puts up with a painful feeling is not encouraging it. They're interacting with it. So they're not doing something for the purpose of torturing themselves or repressing their desires or so on. They're willing to accept the pleasant, and they're willing to accept the unpleasant. And if you don't believe me, I've got here something that I think everyone should maybe look at that might help. It's called the Sabhasava Sutta. And it's called Adivasana. We have this Adivasana. I'll try to find it here. I don't know, I have the Pali here, but it's not really important. In the Sabhasava Sutta, I'll just make reference and you can go and find it yourself. In the Sabhasava Sutta, the Majjhima Nikaya, all of the taints, and here is the link to it I can give you. Oh no, I can't. It says that a person who is looking to give up the defilements in the mind should be willing to put up with painful feeling, even to the extent that it might lead to their death. So any even painful, unbearable, even life-threatening pain should be put up with. And this is the key, is that we're putting up with, and the word is adiwasana, which means to bear with. So as long as we don't misunderstand in this way that we shouldn't bear with things, and we understand that the middle way is actually being able to bear with anything and put up with it and not react, instead of giving rise to greed, anger, or delusion, then I think it's an important teaching. And the idea of the middle way is quite useful. Okay, so as I was saying, the word the perfect one is probably a bad one, but it's not an important point. Just I don't want to confuse people here that why is it using the word perfect? Well, actually it's not. It's using the word the thus gone, or the one who has gone in the right way, or who has come to truth and to rightness. Tata, or tata. Tata means like that, or in that way. Thatness or suchness. And they'll often translate as the thus gone one, which some people might complain about because it's really pretty vague. But I think it's purposefully vague. We see the word Tathagata, it just means the Buddha. It's the word that the Buddha used to talk about himself. And it seems that a potential reason is that it's not self-aggrandizing. It's quite humble of him to say that, I think. There may be other reasons. There certainly probably are that I don't know about. So what it's saying here is that by not going to the two extremes, he has found the Majjhima Patipatthā, the middle way. And the word that he uses is Abhisambuddha. So we have the word Buddha. Buddha is one who knows, right? So here we have the word Abhisambuddha. Abhi means, it gives a higher sense to it. Sambuddha means he came to realize for himself, or rightly realize, or know rightly, this middle way. So through his practice. David, interacting with your pain and sensual desires, looking at it from different directions, does it mean actively think about it and see why these feelings arise? No, I don't think it does at all. It really depends what you mean by seeing why they arise, because the only important thing to do is to look at them and to understand them as they are in that moment. When you do that, you're going to see a lot of things about them. You will potentially see why they arise, because you'll see the other things that are associated with them. And you might skip back and forth to noticing this and noticing that. The feelings won't be the only thing that enter into your contemplation. So it'll be quite clear what leads from one thing to another, but you don't have to think about this, and it doesn't help to think about this, because you'll be seeing it as the practice goes. Nothing lasts for more than an instant. And eventually you'll realize for yourself the interrelatedness of all of experience. So I think the point is, anything that you could think about would be much better off experienced. And thinking about something doesn't give you the same benefit as actually realizing it. So here we have this new way of the Buddha. And what does it do? It gives vision. Chakku karani. Chakku means eye. It gives you the eye of knowledge. Karana means it makes, or it creates, gives rise to. It's the same word as karma. Jnana karani. It gives rise to knowledge or insight. Upasamaya, it leads to peace, because when you see things, when you untie the knots, your mind is clear. You can examine this for yourself. We We sit here, and sometimes we're at peace, sometimes we're happy. And sometimes we have great stress in our minds. Our minds are out of order. We might get a headache from thinking about this or that, or we might feel bored or distressed. We find that even though we're enjoying what's going on, there is some amount of stress based on our state of mind. It can often have to do with what we've gone through during the day, or what we have to look forward to in the rest of the day ahead of us. And when we adjust our minds, when we take up the practice of this middle way, this practice to relate directly to the experience and interact with, or I guess interact is really one of the best words I can think of, rather than react to it, and untie all of the knots, then we can see this. We see, oh, I can see. It's like before we were blind. Many people, after they meditate, they say it's like I was dead before. It's like I wasn't really living before. And suddenly, now I can see. I was blind. It was like I had no vision at all. And so you see all these things about yourself. Some people practice meditation and they think, oh, what a terrible thing. Now I have... before, I didn't have to see all of this. Now all I see inside myself is bad stuff. So they criticize the meditation. They have doubt about the meditation because it's helping them to see the bad things inside of them. Of course, some people don't have a lot of bad things, and so they don't see this. They say, oh, meditation is great. It shows me all my good things. But I think for most of us, we have sufficient badness inside to make meditation an unpleasant thing in the beginning. Because what does it do? It gives vision. It makes you see the truth. It's like you open up this wound and you see, oh, it's full of pus and infection. And then you say, well, better I close it back up. I don't want to see all that awful stuff, right? That's the way to cure it, right? Certainly not. It gives knowledge. And knowledge here is, we should stress, the word is jnana, and it's often translated as insight. But it does just mean knowledge, but it's not a... You know, the word jnana, we use it in such a spiritual way, it means spiritual knowledge, in this sense. Wisdom. It leads to peace. So, as I said, it relaxes the mind. Some people meditate, and in the beginning they feel very tense when they meditate, and they think, wow, this is really making me really tense. And it's not really. It's helping you to see your tension. And that really means that you're on the cusp of overcoming the tension. If you focus on... what happens is normally we identify and associate with the body, and so we don't notice that we're tense. But when you stop meditating, it's like... the body becomes a glove, and suddenly you can feel this kind of artificialness to it. And so it you can feel all of the tension and all of the imbalances in the body. Because you're stepping back and you're actually able to see. You have the chakku, the eye, or the vision. And so it's actually a good sign. And then if you focus on it, you'll be able to actually leverage this dissociation with the body and let go entirely. When you focus on the tension, you say tense, it reaffirms this and it helps you to say, it helps you to realize and to let go. And to see that the body is not, it's not ours. If the audio goes, yeah, just reload it. That doesn't help. Just make sure to hit the reload button. That's what it's there for, because the internet here is still not very good. To direct acquaintance The word direct acquaintance is really a poor translation, I think. Abhinyaya is the word. Abhinyaya doesn't really mean direct acquaintance, and the commentary doesn't think it means that either, as far as I can see. Abhinyaya means higher knowledge. So it's actually the same word as jnana, jnana karani, jnana and abhinyaya, nya, nya, it's the same root, nya. It's just abhi means high. So it leads to knowledge, but it leads to higher knowledge. You see, it's really just the same word, actually. And the commentary says, well, you know, all these words really mean the same thing. But that doesn't mean the Buddha's doing something wrong here. It's actually quite wonderful that he's stringing all of these together. And they point out different facets of the same thing. Abhinyaya, because the word abhinyaya would have been known to them. Abhinyaya can mean any kind of higher knowledge, like knowledge of past lives, knowledge of other people's minds, and so on. But it can also mean knowledge of Nibbana. Sambodhaya, it leads to enlightenment. Sambodhi is enlightenment. Nibbanaya, it leads to Nibbana. In the word samvadati, it means it goes to, or it leads to. So what is the middle way? Well, here we have the just a second. I have to add someone. We have a latecomer. Okay, and here we have, for some of you, many of you, I think this will already be familiar, the Eightfold Noble Path. Many people already know about it. For some of you, it might not. Probably don't want to get too much off track by going into detail, even though this is really, it's really one of the most important parts of the sutta. I don't know. I guess I don't want to get too much into detail about them. Maybe I'll go through each of the eight parts of the Noble Path in brief and just ask you to go and research it on your own. So what is the middle way? Let's talk about the different parts of the middle way. Yeah, I'm using 3G. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about the Eightfold Noble Path. First of all, it's a mouthful, really. Eight parts to the path, and for many people, this is like, whoa. It's a lot. It's really a lot to get your head around. And so there's a bit of a debate as to whether the Buddha actually went into detail when he taught this. I mean, did the Buddha just outline these? Did he just list these off? And the Mahasi Sayadaw, he talks about this and he says, well, you know, it makes sense that he may have actually gone into detail, and that the sutta was just recorded as a heading. And didn't record the whole conversation, which is possible. It might also be that, well, first of all, these guys were pretty sharp and had been practicing, and that really he didn't need to give them a lot of information. It may be that, as in the same way as using synonyms, he was just trying to give them an overview and give them faith, because they were really lacking at this point in faith. They had little faith in him as a person, as an ascetic. because he had given up their ascetic practices. And so here he's giving them something that is really, really, I think, going to blow them away. In that sense, if it's like, wow, 8 parts, how am I going to understand that? It's a lot to get my head around. You might kind of understand why the Buddha would have brought this up. This is one way of looking at it, because it's a way of impressing people. You know, here we have something pretty comprehensive. I mean, it's not just to impress people, it actually is impressive. It's impressive to that the Buddha's teaching is not just let's do this or let's do that. It's no, we've got a well-rounded path here. But how do we get our heads around this? Well, as many of you might be aware, I'm going to comment on this here. Okay, so we have these. The Eightfold Noble Path can be broken up into 3 parts. And these are the eight parts. There are 3 trainings. And morality, and later on, this is going to be an integral part of the Buddha's teaching, these 3 trainings. And he's going to refer to them again and again and again. And it's really the condensed version of the Eightfold Noble Path. So speech, action, and livelihood are morality. Mindfulness and concentration Mindfulness and concentration are the concentration. Or focus. And view and intention are wisdom. So this makes it a little bit easier to understand what we're talking about here. It really starts with, well, it can start with anything, but in the classic exposition, it actually starts with the morality part, because morality is really the base of everything. Some people start the path without morality, and here the Buddha actually started it at wisdom, right? But he's doing it because these guys are already pretty moral and already really focused. And this is interesting in relating to other religious people, because you don't need to talk to them much about morality. You know, if you talk to people who worship God or in other religions, they're often pretty moral people, and they're often quite concentrated. But what they're missing is right view and right intention, or right view anyway, and some part of right intention. And so you start with that. You start with this right view. For other people, they're immoral, so you have to start with morality. For other people, they are unconcentrated, so talking about wisdom or morality is useless. So you have to, you know, get them to focus their minds first. It really doesn't matter where you start, but there are these 3 parts. So putting it in that light, it first makes it easier. But going into deeper detail, we can actually talk about each one of these 8 factors and at least give a definition of them. Right view is, in one sense, it's just giving up all wrong views. The Buddha would always talk about views as being a bad thing. And he much more talks about simply views as being something one should give up. So he has there's this word ditti, and ditti just means to give up. Ditti just means view. It doesn't mean wrong view. But he's always referring to, when he says ditti, he's almost always referring to wrong view. And so, in the majority of cases, we're just to understand right view is giving up all of your views, right? Stop having beliefs and views and opinions. And that's really a powerful teaching. And it's a bold assertion, because what the Buddha is going to then say is that my view is the truth. And, well, yeah, you get that in every religion, right? Every religious leader will tell you that their view is the truth. So what is special? I think what is special about the Buddha's teaching is what we're going to see in the next section up ahead, is that when he says, when we make the assertion, when I make the assertion that the Buddha's view is the truth, then it's just the giving up of all views. The view that the Buddha had was something very, very simple and very, very empirical, experiential. It has to do with our experience of this world on a moment-to-moment basis, of this universe. And so that's where we're going to get into the Four Noble Truths. And the technical definition of right view is this, that it's going to be the next paragraph. He doesn't make that clear here, but in one sense you might take that as his way of teaching. So rather than go through all of the eight path factors and explain them all out, he doesn't even mention which is which and what is the definition of each. He just goes right into the first one and helps them to bring about right view, because that's what he's chosen as his entry point into his teaching. He said, here you have the Eightfold Noble Path with right view at the beginning. And this is the standard exposition of the Eightfold Noble Path, but it has special importance here because he's dealing with people who have wrong view. And so his reason for bringing that up first may be at least partly the importance of instilling right view, and that's what he does in the next paragraph. And he talks about the Four Noble Truths. The understanding of the Four Noble Truths is right view. And the giving up of any other view. When you say, I believe this, I believe that, the only belief that is useful is the Four Noble Truths. Belief in the Four Noble Truths. And even that is pretty limited. Eventually it's no longer a view, it's a vision or knowledge. You know? As we said, chakku karani, jnana karani, it's the realization for oneself. Right intention is often translated as right thought as well. I don't know what's better. Intention might be good, but I think right thought makes it a clearer picture. We're talking about what you do with your views. When you have right view, it leads you to think in the right way, right? When you have wrong view, it leads you to think in the wrong way. For instance, if you believe that everyone has to worship your God or else they're going to hell, then that really is going to play a large part in how you think and in how you interact with other people and how you live your lives. If you think that all you have to do is believe in God and you're going to heaven, that will also have an important effect on the way you live your life. It will have an important effect on your mind. If you don't believe in God, if you don't believe in any spirituality, if you don't believe in the existence of the mind, as you can see with people who are hardened atheists in terms of being materialists and skeptics and so on, you can see how it affects their mind. Their thoughts become very, very carnal and coarse and very much in the physical realm. And so right intention here is based on our understanding of yeah. Okay, so the comment is that there's a lot of importance given to the Four Noble Truths, and the three characteristics are not stressed so much, when it should be the other way around. Well, you have to see the importance of the Four Noble Truths, because they're the theoretical or the philosophical framework under which the three characteristics work. What's the consequence of things being impermanent, suffering, and non-self? It's that as a result there is suffering, and what do we do to overcome it? I mean, the three characteristics don't give a path, they don't give any philosophical framework. They just say something. It says, you know, it's a fact of life. I'm not trying to put it down, and as we'll see in the next sutta, I don't know if we're going into it, the Buddha gives great importance to the three characteristics. He dedicates an entire sutta, and actually it's that sutta that brings about enlightenment, arahantship in all five of the ascetics. It's an incredibly powerful discourse. But it's not philosophical in the same way that the Four Noble Truths are. So remember, what he's doing here is he's introducing Buddhism, he's introducing his philosophy to these people. And that's, I think, why you find it, I think maybe rightly so, why the Four Noble Truths play an important, or are given more prominence. Because most people are just wanting to know, what is Buddhism about? Well, Buddhism isn't really about the three characteristics per se. And in fact, that's incomprehensible to most people, because they haven't experienced the three characteristics. If you talk about that, it in fact seems like quite a terrible, really an incomprehensible teaching for most people. But the Four Noble Truths, if understood in the right way, see, the problem is when teachers talk about the Four Noble Truths, and I've talked about this before, they always say, "What's the first noble truth?" The first noble truth is that life is suffering, right? This is what they say. Well, look at what we have here. There's nowhere in the next paragraph where it says life is suffering. Any Buddhist teacher who says the first noble truth is life is suffering should be called to task for it. This is a terrible way to present the Buddha's teaching, and it's not true. It's not how the Buddha presented his teaching. If you look at the three characteristics, it kind of implies that there's no experience you could have that is truly satisfying. But it's a terrible way to present your religion. If you present the Four Noble Truths in the right way, it's really a good introduction. Because, you know, if people aren't able to accept the truth of suffering, that it exists, that birth is suffering, aging is suffering, and so on, then, you know, there's really not much more you can say or do for them. But if you're talking to sensitive people who are open-minded, then pretty much everyone should be able to accept the first noble truth, that, yeah, it's true, getting old kind of sucks, and death is a pretty terrifying thing. All the rest of it is very clear. Sickness is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair. Are these suffering? Yeah, everyone can agree. So it's, what I mean to say is, it's just a philosophical exposition. The three characteristics are, when he gets them, he hooks them, right? He's hooked them with this. This is the introduction to his teaching. And all that happens is Anya Kondanya becomes a Sotapanna, which isn't really apparently countless Brahmas, gods as well, became Sotapanna as well. Or Arahantship even. No, I think they all became Sotapanna. But it's really, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's not really the best result that the Buddha's ever had, but it's an important exposition. But once he gets them, then he teaches them the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, boom, they become arahant. Because that's where they're really meditating. Here, that's just philosophy. It's more on the philosophy side, trying to get them over to right view, to give up their wrong views, and so that to get them to the point where they can say, well, yeah, you know, we really haven't gained anything the way we're practicing. Why? Because we've been missing stuff. We've been missing the right mindfulness. We've been missing right view. We've been missing right intention. Here we've been torturing ourselves, banging our heads against the wall. Once they get to that point, and you know, Anya Kondanya becomes a sotapanna, and the skies open up, and the angels start saying, you know, at the end of the sutta, it gets kind of obvious. Well, they have a lot more faith at that point, and then they can put in their full effort and full attention. So I think there's the distinction that I would make, that you don't want to talk to newcomers to Buddhism about the three characteristics. I think it's a waste of time. Even beginners meditators, we mention it, but the best way is to talk to them about the Eightfold Noble Path, you know, teach them about morality, have them start to be mindful and explain to them right view, if you like, and get them to start practicing. Then when they practice, they're going to come to you and say, oh man, my mind is in chaos, thinking this, thinking that. I've got all this pain in my body, I've got a headache, it's stressful, and I'm watching the stomach rising and falling, but I find myself trying to control it. It just becomes viscerally clear to them. You don't have to explain anything. You just point it out to them. You say, well, you know, what you're seeing is actually what we're trying to understand. And you're seeing the problem with clinging. And that is, what's the problem with clinging? Is that everything that you can cling to is impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. When you cling to it, you're only going to give rise to suffering. And I think that's a really natural way of progressing. Well, so anyway, that's my take on the distinction between the two, and I think it's borne out by the course of these two discourses. Why the Buddha didn't give the Anattalakkhana Sutta first is for that reason, that he had to accept them in his philosophy, and he had to give them a general overview, which he does here very well. Also, this is his first discourse, so he has to give something fairly broad. He has to set down what is his religion. What is my religion? What is my code? This is my code. And from this point on, if anyone wants to know what the Buddha taught, they have this. This is what gave rise to asajji. Asajji is one of the five ascetics. He went on to teach Sariputta. If you listened to my last or watched my last Dhammapada video, he said Upatissa comes to Asajji and asks him, "What does your teacher teach?" And Asajji says, I really don't know a lot. I've only had one discourse. At this time he was an arahant, so he would have had both discourses. He also the Anattalakkhana Sutta, so he had already heard both of them, and gotten some other teachings from the Buddha. But he said, I haven't heard a lot. I'm new to this religion. And Upatissa says, no problem. Give me the core. And so he says, Ye dhamma hetu bhava te sanghetung tathagata ahu. He says, all of those dhammas that arise based on a cause. The Buddha, the Tathagata, here we have this word again, has taught the cause of those dhammas. And with this he became a sotapanna. And so what he's talking about here is the Four Noble Truths, right? Suffering has a cause, and the cessation of suffering comes with a cause as well, or comes with a path. So it's very much overview of Buddhism. I think the Four Noble Truths puts everything in perspective. Another thing about the Four Noble Truths is that there is an emphasis on including the Four Noble Truths. There's somewhere in the commentaries that it says that after a certain point, the monks realized that they had to include it in all their discourses or something like that. Because there was a point where Sariputta didn't teach the Four Noble Truths. He just taught this man how to go to the Brahma world. As a result, when the man died, he went to the Brahma world. And the Buddha chastised him and said, or kind of said, he's gone and been reborn in the Brahma worlds now, kind of pointedly saying, that's really not the ultimate. And so the Sariputta went and taught him the Four Noble Truths up in the Brahma worlds, and he became enlightened, something like that. Right, so anyway, right intention or right thought, it means any thought that is, or thought that is without the desire to hurt others, thought that is free from sensual desire, and thoughts that are free from arrogance or conceit or delusion, desire to repress others, this holding ourselves up and putting other people down. But basically it means thoughts or intentions. It is really a good translation, because it's the intentions that are based on good things. When we want to do this or do that, it's the intention in the mind that is clearly understanding cause and effect. Right speech means the abstention from wrong speech, which is not lying or gossiping or backbiting or useless speech. Right action means the abstention from wrong action, which is killing, stealing, and cheating. And right livelihood is just the combination of right speech and right action when applied to our way of life, our means of obtaining our sustenance. So not killing to make a living, not lying to make a living, and so on. Right effort is the balancing of our effort. Right effort is the giving up of unwholesomeness, putting out effort to give up unwholesomeness and to take up wholesomeness, to prevent unwholesomeness and to guard wholesomeness. It's four right efforts. Again, you can look this all up. It's on the internet. Right mindfulness is mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the feelings, mindfulness of the mind, and mindfulness of the dhammas. So this is basically the practice which we give to people in the beginning, with the hope that they're already being moral, or with the hope that it will help them to see the importance of morality and give rise to right view. But when people come to meditate, we just give them the four foundations of mindfulness. It's clear that the Buddha stressed this on many occasions, especially on occasions where people were already in the position to practice meditation. It's something the Buddha called the only way. So it was the kind of the another way of entry into the Eightfold Noble Path. Yeah, is right livelihood redundant? And I've thought about this before. And actually, really, all three of the moralities are pretty redundant, in the sense that when you're sitting in meditation, you're not going to commit any of these. You're not going to break any of these. And the Eightfold Noble Path is just one moment in your meditation practice. So there's no opportunity for right speech, right action, or right livelihood at all. So actually what the Buddha's doing here is, as I said, he's giving a comprehensive exposition, and he's cutting off all possible avenues for for wrongness, right? For the arising of defilement. And in that sense, livelihood is really important. It's something that is very much a part of our lives. What do we spend most of our lives doing? Making a living, right? When we live in the world, we spend what percentage of our lives just trying to make ends meet, trying to find a job and work and keep our jobs and so on. So it's an important entry point. It's an important doorway for defilements to enter. That's really all it means. I mean, wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration. All of these are what is the problem. And here the Buddha is cutting off all of those doors. You know, if you're living your life in the wrong way, it's going to be very difficult to practice. So giving up wrong livelihood is an important... I mean, it's just an important point to make that your livelihood also has to be pure. But yeah, when as long as you have right speech and right action, you also have right livelihood. So, on the one hand, in another sense, you may not, because suppose you are a business person, and you have to do advertising. Well, but then you're still talking about right speech, no? I imagine there's the sense in which even trying to make a living could be considered a hindrance to the path, right? You know, going out to work every day, being concerned about money and trying to make a living, you know, is something that will take your mind off of the path. So really, right livelihood might in this sense be referring to the renunciant life. So it might not be encompassed in right speech and right action, unless you take right speech and right action to the extremes. I think it's just another way of fleshing out, and again, synonyms, right? Just because they're synonymous doesn't mean they're not important. So by including livelihood in there, the Buddha has kind of fleshed it out and explained what he's really talking about, that actually you have to live your life in the right way. And also it makes 8, which is, I guess, a good thing. Although 7 is a good number as well. But I think there's, you know, it feels right to have livelihood in there, I think. But we have right mindfulness, right concentration. Right concentration is said to be the 4 jhanas. So it's the focus of mind. It's where your mind is clear, where your mind is not caught up by defilements. And through the practice of mindfulness, your mind becomes clear. And if you practice intense meditation, you can get to quite intense states of concentration. But what is important about right concentration is that it's including right mindfulness. So it's actually the clear awareness of the experience. It's not that you're practicing some kind of transcendental meditation to gain trance states. The 4 jhanas are simply where your mind becomes fixed and focused on a single object. So when you see something, when you hear something, you're able to see it clearly. And then the 2nd jhana, you stop thinking about it. The 3rd, and you're just clearly aware of it. The 3rd jhana, you become neutral the 3rd jhana, you become calm and tranquilized, so you don't have this, your mind is no longer agitated. And in the 4th jhana, you become calm, you become neutral about it. And in this sense, it's the neutrality of wisdom that comes when you get to the higher stages of knowledge. I have two meditators here now today, and actually they're in this state of equanimity right now. They've both been practicing for some time, and they both reached it on the same day. So they both came to me today and were able to confirm that at this point they're neutral about everything. You know, it's not something I even talk about. I don't tell them you have to be neutral or so on. We're not trying to push them into it. But they come to it by themselves, and they say, yeah, you know, I mean, I feel really calm. But then they qualify that, and they say, but you know, it's not like I'm clinging to it, or it's really kind of just, I'm just pretty neutral. You know, whatever comes up, I'm just looking at it as it is. And they'll tend to, you know, be able to explain this in whatever way is conventional for them to explain it. But they will come to a great sense of equanimity that is based on wisdom, and that's the sign that they're on the verge of gaining real insight and transformative insight. This is where the mind is able to then let go. Okay, so that's the Eightfold Noble Path. I think we should just stop there, because we've been going for over an hour, and I assume other people have other things that they do in their lives besides study the Dhamma. So unless everyone feels like that's not enough, I'd like to stop there for this week. And I think that's a fairly good pace. We've made two paragraphs today, which is nice. No, but it's a nice pace because people are asking questions, and actually we are covering a lot of ground, even though the sutta is only slowly being transversed. We've been talking about quite a few things, or I've been talking about quite a lot. And so I'd like to thank everyone for the questions, the comments, and the interaction. I think it's good to see. It's a sign that people are actually interested. So I'll give one last opportunity. If people have questions, please go ahead and ask, and we can continue the discussion. But I'm going to wrap it up there as far as our progress in the sutta. So just this last part here is that this is the middle way that is discovered by the perfect one. He just repeats, and again, here's another confirmation of what I said, that it's all about repetition. It's all about going over it again. Why? Because he's trying to impress this on his meditators, the people in front of him who are practicing. And I find myself doing this again and again. You'll go over the same thing with the meditators again and again. And it's not because they haven't heard it and they aren't intellectually aware of it, but it's to bring their minds back to the state again. So here they are thinking about right view, right intention. What is all this? This is the middle way that I discovered, as I just said. And it brings their minds back to that. And then they start doubting again, and he says, but look, this gives vision, it gives knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct, to higher knowledge, to discovery. What is the word discovery? Sambodaya, to enlightenment is the word. Why he couldn't use the word enlightenment? This is Nyanamoli, he's a great translator, but he has some interesting ideas about translation words, which is a good thing, because he's actually putting some thought into his translations. Whether that's really a good thing or not, I don't know. But he wants to be clear, and that's a good thing. But I think enlightenment is a better word than discovery. And to Nibbana, which he doesn't translate. So, now we are here. So can I have some feedback? If people don't have questions, can you give some comments or constructive criticism? Is the audio audible? I guess some people are not having any problem. I think part of it might be actually where our server is located. Although it's funny that it seems like maybe people in Los Angeles don't even have very good connection to the server, because the server's in Los Angeles. And if anyone has suggestions for how we can change this study group to make it more useful, the kind of things they'd like to see added. Great. So the audio is okay, not perfect, but getting there. Here's an off-topic question. Where does your other name, Noah Greenspoon, come from? Well, my father's name is Lloyd, Jerome Lloyd Greenspoon. So my first name, the first name they gave me was Noah. The issue of names is an interesting one. But where that one comes from is pretty easy. That was the name I was given when I was born. My middle name is actually Herschel. So my birth name is Noah Herschel Greenspoon. Greenspoon is a fairly unique Jewish name. You know, you hear Greenspan, Greenberg, and so on. But Greenspoon is fairly unique. There was a famous wrecking company in Canada that my relatives put together. It's now been sold, and some non-Greenspoons own it. But anyway, that's where the name comes from. But you know, people often shun these names. Monks will often shun these names, and you'll see a lot of monks that have given them up. So I've more or less given it up. I use the name Yutadhamma mostly. Why I tend to say Noah Yutadhamma is because that's the way they do it in Thailand. Rather than giving up their first name, they use it when they talk to each other. So, but that might be, that's probably because in Thailand they have two names. They have a nickname and then they have a real name. So their real name is a longer name, and they give that up. They tend to give that up. But they will talk, when they talk to each other, they'll use the word Prat Noah or Prat, you know, they'll use the word Tuttok or Prat Tok or Prat Chai or Prat. But they do use their real names as well. You know, we have Prat Pon Pitak. I'm thinking back about the monks Prat Pomuan, Prat Pasong, these names. They never use the in ordinary monastic society in Thailand, they use their Thai names. I mean, you have all these students of Ajahn Chah with all of these long names, like well, you have Sumedho and Brahmavangso, these two teachers under Ajahn Chah. And then you have Ajahn Chah, who's just Ajahn Chah, which Chah is his Thai name. And then Ajahn Chah's teacher is Lungpo Man, and Man is just his Thai name. And Phuong and Som and all of these teachers in that tradition. Now, the question is, what is the correct way? And people, the purists, will always say, well, the correct way is to keep your Pali name and to give up your old name. But it's not clearly the case, because many monks in the Buddha's time kept their original name. Some didn't, most did. The two chief disciples of the Buddha changed their names. We have Upatissa became Sariputta, his mother's name was Sari. And Kolita became Moggallana, because his mother or his village's name was Moggallana or something like that. But many of the Buddha's disciples didn't change their names. So Ananda stayed as Ananda, Anuruddha stayed as Anuruddha, Soma stayed as Soma, and so on. It looks like in most cases they kept their names. Angulimala didn't keep his name. Ahimsaka, he didn't keep it. Anyway, the king decided to call him based on his parents' name, because he thought, well, Angulimala is a bad one. Okay, so some questions here. Jen, you want to know? Yes, I said Prat. Prat is a Thai word. It actually should be P-R-A. P-H is Fra, no? Prat. And David, I don't understand your question, I'm sorry. But the Skype sessions are for one-on-one, so if you're interested in meditation, I guess, if that's what you're asking, it's for people who are looking for instruction on their meditation practice. And if we can ask an off-topic question, how many pieces does your robe have, and is there a video where one can learn how to wear it? Well, you're not allowed to wear the robe unless you're a monk. It would be pretending. So keep that as classified information on a need-to-know basis. I mean, the information's all out there if you want to find it, but I wouldn't want to give you the idea that you should go about learning how to put it on. But I only wear three pieces. I have a three-piece robe, lower robe, upper robe, and outer robe. And the outer robe we don't wear so often. The upper robe I won't even wear when I'm in my room. Right now I'm wearing it because I'm teaching and I feel it's important to have some, even though you can't see me, I put it on to make it kind of formal. But I will probably take it off when I'm finished, and then I'll go around with just my lower robe, like just a skirt, or I guess a skirt is the, and that's what monks would wear in the forest. Then we have the outer robe when we go into the village or when it's cold, and that I use as a blanket. It's twice as thick as my upper robe. So I have three. And when I wash, you know, most monks have started keeping two sets, which is funny because we're not allowed to. But I don't, and I don't know how many monks actually do that anymore. But it's a lot of fun because when you wash one, you have to wear the other. So you'll wash your lower robe, and then you have to wear your upper robe, and then you wash your upper robe, and you have to wear your outer robe, and so on. But I really only have three robes that I own, and that's all I wear. And I don't wash them that often, so I don't. I'm not the most fragrant of people, but it doesn't really bother me. Probably a lot of the questions should wait till tomorrow. That's more the idea is that tomorrow we have a question and answer session, and that's when all these off-topic questions could be answered. Probably better for us to stay on topic here, or better for me anyway, because then I don't have to answer lots and lots of questions. But okay, I'll take this last one, Amanda's question. Tips for controlling hunger after noon. There's no way to control hunger. You shouldn't try to control it. And just when you're hungry, just say to yourself, hungry, hungry. I mean, it's great. I'm surprised to hear that it sounds like people are actually trying to keep the eight precepts at home, which is wonderful. It's pretty cool. I mean, it makes you special in a way, really. I always tried to get my Thai students to do that, and they always... It was like horrible, this idea of actually keeping the eight precepts at home, and no one ever did it. But some people, and I did. Some people were able to, but only a select few. Hunger doesn't become as much of an issue when you're in a meditation center and when you're meditating intensively. But it is certainly I went to university on eight precepts for a year. I lived in a monastery in Canada. And for a year, 8 months of university, I was keeping eight precepts. And there were times where I would go hungry. I mean, we cheated a lot because back then I didn't really have a clear understanding of the precepts. And so we would have... Sometimes we would have tapioca pudding in the evening, and quite often, actually, we would have tapioca pudding in the evening. But it was really cold in Canada, so... Well, I mean, anyway, it was cheating in the end. But I also had very little money at the time. This is part of why I was staying in the monastery. It's because you know, my parents wanted me to go back to university, but I didn't really have the money to do it. So based on my Buddhist practice, I thought, well, the best thing is to go and stay at a monastery. Just a little church, actually, that they had bought and were using as a place for people to come and worship. And I lived with one monk there. And so some days I went actually with very little food because I had very little money. And there was a period of time, I think, where I ate very, very little. You know, maybe even a day or two where I went without food because I just had no money. And that was an interesting experience. I mean, it was actually such a wonderful experience to feel that. And there's this quote, George Orwell says, and it's like, when you've reached the bottom, it's such a relief because you're there and it's not so bad and you can handle it. And you have no more this fear of poverty because you're poor. It's an experience that really everyone should go through, is giving up and having nothing, not having a nest egg. Of course, most people are not in a very good position. Jen, no smoothies are not allowed. I met one monk who said, I only eat one meal a day. And people say, oh, how can you eat one meal a day? And he would explain it to me. He was like bragging about how he ate only one meal a day. And he said, well, in the afternoon I have a smoothie with two bananas, you know, a milkshake with two bananas. And then he was listing these things and it was like nuts. And he grinds up nuts and puts in this in his milkshake. And so, no, you can't have smoothies. The only thing in the afternoon that's allowed is strained fruit juice or vegetable juice that has no pulp whatsoever in it. The Buddha gave an allowance for juice, but that's strictly speaking the juice. No, my parents were a little bit concerned about my way of life at that point. So they weren't actively supportive of what I was doing at that time. And you know how it goes in the West with a lot of people. They want you to make your own way. I don't know, some parents support their children. Some parents want their children to support themselves. But no, my parents helped me a lot in life and gave me a lot. They supported me a lot more before I became Buddhist, I think. I don't know if that's true. But there was a time where it was quite strained. And that's not even true because my parents did help me. They were just kind of concerned with the way I was going and, you know, didn't really want to encourage me in it. Anyway, that's enough for now. I'm not going to answer more questions. If you have questions, come back tomorrow. Otherwise, no one will have a reason to come to our radio session. So, tomorrow at 2 p.m. UTC, you go to radio.sirimangalo.org and if no, you go to radio.sirimangalo.org. It's a different location because it's a different setup. There's actually video. We're using Ustream. And there's lots of nice advertisements and so on from Ustream. So hopefully you can find some way to block all of those advertisements. Maybe that blocking them just means to say hearing. Hopefully they're not too bad. And if anyone here is coming tomorrow and you'd like to participate, you can try to figure out how the broadcasting works and you can actually get set up so that you come on air and somehow I invite you to join me, and then we can actually see you and you can ask a question on video, which would be something new. Yeah, okay, so tomorrow, 2 p.m., radio. I don't think that affects my internet. I think they go through Ustream. I don't know, really. Maybe it does. Well, we can only try. Okay, so I'm going to turn off the audio now. That's enough for today. I'll stay on text chat for a little bit longer. Thanks everyone for coming. And all the best.